welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm delighted to bring an interview with the award-winning literary fantasy author, Karen Hewler. Not long ago, Karen and I had a great chat about writing literary fantasy, what this subgenre and style of writing entails. And we also talk an awful lot about pantsing, because Karen is a complete pantser. And it's great to talk with someone about this process and the benefits of it, and also how you can give it a go yourself if you're more of a plotter. Before we dive in, just a quick reminder to subscribe or follow the show so you don't miss any future episodes. We've got loads coming up, including our next panel on the 25th of June. So if you want to come along to the live event with science fiction and fantasy literary agent Laura Bennett, then just click the link in the description to join our Discord server. So if you've got any questions about querying agents, working with agents, or finding publishers, come along and ask Laura Bennett. As always, the recorded version will go live on the podcast shortly after. But to find out more, just click the link in the description. If you enjoy the show and you want us to do even more, then your support goes an awful long way. You can do that by sharing our episodes on social media, or by telling anyone who you think may be interested, by giving us a quick rating on Spotify mobile app or on iTunes. And you can also check out our Patreon page if you want to get access to more fantasy writing related resources like writing classes, books, interviews, guides, and much, much more. Now it's time to dive in, and I'm delighted to welcome to the Toolshed, Karen Hewler. I'm delighted to welcome award-winning literary, sci-fi, and fantasy author, Karen Hewler. Karen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be here.
Oh, I'm thrilled to have you. Thank you very much for joining me. I've been reading your brand new book, The Splendid City, which was published by Angry Robot in June last year, and loving it a lot. I'm a big Master and Margarita fan, and I understand that it has a bit of an influence from that book. Can you tell us a bit about it then?
As you noticed, there is a sort of tip of the hat to Mikhail Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita, one of my favorite books. If I had to compile a top 10 list, and I don't know how anyone can do a top 10, it's got to be top 20, 30, or something like that. But The Master and Margarita was a sort of breakthrough book for me when I first read it, late 60s, early 70s. It was a kind of mind-blowing, because I was an English major, which meant basic literary English stories. Yeah. And magic realism, which was just really becoming pronounced at that point, blew me away. I loved it. I adored it. It was a whole new world for me. And one of the characters in it, in Master and Margarita, the devil comes to Moscow, and it's all about literary politics. And the devil is accompanied by a big black cat. And the cover that I remember that influenced me the most had a big black cat standing on his hind legs with a bow tie and brandishing a gun very casually. Yeah. That cover and that character always stayed with me. And at some point in the past 5 years or so, I don't remember exactly, I wrote a scene opening with that cat in the United States. And he's a very self-aggrandizing, very confident, very pushy, overbearing cat who is not afraid to use his gun. At the same time, a little bit after that, Trump got elected president. And for those of us who did not, who were not Trump followers, this was very disconcerting. So it's at a certain point, it all started coming together. I had written the scene about the cat without having anything to attach it to, and suddenly became part of a larger story. So in the Splendid City, Texas secedes from the United States and becomes a breakaway republic called Liberty. In Liberty, in the main city, is also called Liberty. In Liberty, there's a president who lives in a palace. There are perpetual parades supporting him. There are planned protest marches just to pretend that it's actually a free city. There's a water shortage due to the fact that a river has been stolen, supposedly by the Democrats. So it's a sort of dystopia, but it's a parade-driven dystopia. There are vans screaming down the street that will just give someone a brand new car, for instance, or another reward. But occasionally they take people away, and the rumor is that they're taken away to a fabulous vacation, so but nobody really minds.
Yeah.
There are also presidential heads along the street that check in with people asking if they're happy. And if they know someone who isn't unhappy, who isn't happy, please report them so that the president can make them happy. So it's very much a surveilled society.
Yeah.
At the same time, in New York, there's a young woman, fairly young, Eleanor, who finds out that she's actually a witch, or a kind of raw, uneducated witch. And she joins a coven where she goes through an educational process to become a proper witch. And there are lots of rules about it, that you can't make a spell, a transformation spell, before you're ready, because there are lots of things that have to be technically done in order for that to happen properly. She works at a gift shop with a very overbearing character named Stan, who is constantly on her back, constantly trying to manipulate her. And because of one thing he does, she turns him into a cat. She violates all the rules. She also forgot to put the undoing part into the spell. So as a punishment, the coven sends her to Liberty because there's a missing witch there. They also send Stan, who is now a cat, there as well, as a kind of punishment. He has to learn to be better behaved. But Liberty is actually his ideal world. That's the bare bones of the story. It is a satire. I think a lot of it is very funny. Is outrageous. He's one of those characters that authors love to grow, love to write about. He's impossible to put down once he starts. And it's very easy because he's got a lot of personality.
Yeah, he does. As soon as I started reading it, I think it starts with his perspective as well, doesn't it? And he's just talking to a girl on the street. And the way he just changes so suddenly is, it's like so shocking, but it's funny, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's a brilliant book. Is it going to be part of a series, or is this a standalone story?
No, it's meant to be a standalone, though people seem to... Well, there are so many trilogies being written and series being written that I think a lot of people expect it to be a first book. I've never... It's an interesting thing to me, because when I'm done usually. And I don't think I have the mindset for someone who can write a series. I think... I may be a little impatient, whereas I want to finish something and move on to the next thing. And in my mind, the next thing is always different, rather than take these characters to have something else happen. I've been thinking about it. This is the second time there have been a lot of people thinking this is the first book of a series. And I'm thinking, well, it's interesting. I've never actually intended to do a second book in either this or the other one, where it was more pronounced that people assumed it was the first book. I've never thought about it, but in the back of back of my mind, I say, well, why not think about it? You know, what would happen if I tried to do it? It's not, you know, writers don't always write perfect things. I've abandoned so many things in my life that, you know, I would like to think I'm fearless about going forward, making a mistake, and then ditching it. I ditch lots of things. So what would be so horrible if I tried it? I don't know. It's something I've been thinking about.
Yeah. Oh, well, you never know. Your subconscious mind's always working away in the background, isn't it?
It is. It is. And that's, you know, I've taught as an adjunct at NYU for a number of years, and that would be the adult division, you know, people who are not there for a degree.
Yeah.
And I keep telling them, you know, so much of writing happens in the back of your mind. If you're not writing right now, it doesn't mean you're not actually working on it. I find that very often I need a period where I'm not actively writing something, because in the back of my mind, or at odd points during the day, I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, and sometimes, like I think, like you said there, you had the idea, the scene for, written for the cat, and then it was only when Trump got elected that the sort of pieces
Yes.
all. So sometimes you find a piece, and you're not too sure what kind, what puzzle it's part of, do you? You just got to keep collecting the pieces, and then the picture becomes clearer, I suppose. It's a really interesting process.
Just about everything will feed the possibilities of what you're writing. In the course of the day, I'm reading news items, I'm reading interesting, odd items. I'm reading about pythons right now in Florida, but there was an alligator found in Brooklyn last month or the month before. So the pot, and that's one of the things that interests me so much about magic realism is the sense that more things are possible
Yeah.
than we really are aware of in the course of our day. We're not, even though I live in New York City, it's the world is not all buildings and streets and honking cars, and anything can happen. An alligator in a local
Yeah.
park can happen.
So
So
it's quite liberating, isn't it?
the sense of possibility is
Yeah.
intriguing.
Yeah, that's why I love writing fantasy as well. It's because there's limitless opportunities. Like,
Yes.
I love telling human stories, but why not have a dragon? It makes it a bit more unique, I suppose, doesn't it? But yeah, it sounds fantastic, and it's a style I really love, magical realism as a genre, sorry, I really love. But I think it lends itself really well to the literary style as well. And what I really liked about Splendid City is the way that you've written it in that sort of literary fantasy, sort of dystopian approach. Could you tell us a bit about that and how you have you always sort of had that sort of writing style, or is that something that you've developed over time?
I started publishing stories, I suppose, in the 80s, perhaps, and I thought I still am a literary writer.
Yeah.
Even though I had spent my 20s reading science fiction and fantasy, and then in my 30s moved over into detective stories, especially cozy mysteries.
Yeah.
The bulk of my reading was literary, obsessed with the New York Times Book Review, that kind of thing. But most of the stories I was writing, or a lot of them anyway, sort of were at the very edge of reality. Things would happen a little bit strangely, more magic realism, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I got a lot published considering that I was at the edge of literary fiction. But then I'd say 20, 25 years ago or something, and I don't remember how it happened. I suddenly realized that the stories that I liked the most, my own stories that I liked the most, were the ones that really were taking a step outside reality. And I
Yeah.
started actively investigating science fiction and fantasy stories. And I realized suddenly, hey, I think I belong here.
Yeah.
So I started taking the least realistic or the ones that were the most fantastic and sending them to science fiction and fantasy magazines and started getting published there. And I also started going to readings. And what I found, what delighted me, was that it's a very supportive community. Science
Yeah.
fiction fantasy writers are extremely supportive. They like to get together. They're very friendly. Now, as
Yeah.
opposed to, this may be my own perspective, but the literary community is huge. And it's also, it seemed to me, very much, I guess the only word I could think of, it's very much segregated into those who win awards or are considered very high class literary. And then there's the
Yeah.
rest of us. And
Little
I never
bit
really
elitist.
felt that sense of community that I felt when I started writing more and more science fiction and fantasy. Right now, I
Yeah.
consider myself to be in both worlds, the fantastic and the literary, though I do write more fantastic literature than literary.
Yeah.
But I bring my education with me, which was all literary fiction. And there are a lot of science fiction and fantasy writers right now who have a huge literary balance in their writing
Yeah.
and do as I do, which is refer to lots of other books and other writers. In the Splendid City, there are lots of allusions to other writers and other books, it's not too hard to see the president as being somehow the Wizard of Oz. Those presidential heads that are on the street are actually a kind of reference to Philip K. Dick's missing animatronic head. I've always loved the fact that they built an animatronic Philip K. Dick, shipped it somewhere, but the head got lost. That head is out somewhere. And so as a writer, I pick and choose from things I have loved over the years, images, histories, anecdotes, anything. And I throw them in wherever it feels right. And I think there's so much of that going on right now, especially in the science fiction and fantasy community, that we encourage stories to talk to each other in meaningful ways, that we're drawing on not only a community of writers, but a community of characters as well that we're comfortable with.
Yeah. Like you said before, it's a lot more freeing, isn't it? So it can embrace the sort of rapidly changing world that we live in and the sort of trends and things that are emerging in that world. So it's there's a lot of experimentation, a lot of freedom to do that as well. So that's why I think it's such a great thing. And like you say, everyone's so supportive, like going to the conventions. Like I'd never really... I always felt a bit intimidated about going to that. And then when you get there, you realize that you were daft for feeling that way in the first place because everyone's so nice.
Yes.
But yeah, it's what I've sort of found, because we've sort of built a community up around this podcast and got a few hundred writers in it. And everyone loves to read each other's stories because we're all fans of the genre anyway. So it's we just get to read the fiction that we like.
Yeah, and I love, I'm on Facebook a lot, and I've got lots of writer friends on Facebook, and I love how people will start talking about a book or a writer I've never heard of and would never ordinarily encounter. And then suddenly I am exposed to a completely different culture or a completely different kind of writing. And it's that ability to share. And I'm not saying the literary community doesn't do that. They do, of course. But I really value how willing writers are to propose other writers because they like their writing so much and not see them as competition necessarily.
Definitely, yeah. I know things could be quite adversarial, can't they? Especially imagine when there's all these lucrative awards up for grabs and there's always a little bit of bitterness lingering about, isn't it? I was going to just ask you about the literary style because it's something that's always fascinated me. I mean, what would you say the defining feature of that style is?
Yeah. Oh, that's a tough one. Wow. Okay. I've never actually sat down and thought about what literary style means. I mean, I could say it's like pornography. You know it when you see it. It's not helpful. I think it's a well-built sentence is something we all appreciate, a sentence that has style, content, and is also a beautiful thing to read and to listen to. Sometimes, and well, literary fiction is also much more character-driven, for example. It's almost based its identity on being character-driven. I think science fiction and fantasy are also character-driven, but there is a great deal of emphasis on the world and the plot and what happens. Yeah. Literary fiction seems to be a little restrained to me in terms of what it's willing to try. So we tend to go back an awful lot to navel gazing, people like me feeling as horrible as I feel, and this the world is so sad. Whereas I think in science fiction and fantasy, there's a willingness to step out away from that and explore what's making the world bad or what can make it good. I think the first divide is really character being more literary and science fiction and fantasy perhaps being more plot driven. I'm sure if I had time to think about it, I could come up with both sides of the fence, come up with authors who are totally the opposite But I think loosely that's probably correct.
Yeah, I think I agree with that as well. It makes sense to me. Like the sort of literary books you do read, they're very much sort of zoomed in on characters and what's going on through their minds, or there's a lot of sort of philosophical debates. And yeah, it's a hard thing to put your finger on, isn't it? But that's what makes it interesting. You touched upon coming up with ideas before, and I was just wondering, you said you had to ditch quite a few or abandon projects. I mean, do you have any trouble coming up with inspiration for ideas? And have you got how do you sort of know which ones you need to ditch?
You haven't heard that you can write away to New Jersey and get a whole list of ideas for your next
novel.
there is this is an answer to the fact that all writers get asked where your ideas come from. And for me, it's all daydreaming. I think writing is exactly daydreaming, but putting it down on paper or on the computer or whatever, an idea will come out of nowhere as I just think about things or as I respond to things. For instance, the story I wrote, I was gardening and I must have come across a rock or a stone as I was digging. And the end result was a story where people were growing, because the rock or the stone reminded me of a hat. So therefore there were people growing up, and that kind of probably sprang forward from the old Jason stories where he sowed dragon's teeth and a whole crop of soldiers were grown. So, it amused me to think as these people grew, not only did they have hats, but they maybe had briefcases. They all had cardboard coffee cups. So there were actually a whole new crop of business people, and it made sense that they eventually would mature and step out of the soil, and they would be the next new crop of people inhabiting the earth. So ideas will start anywhere. And then as writers, we pull in so many things that grow out of that original start. But there are so many things that start and go nowhere for me. I'm a Gemini, and that might explain it, but I tend to have tons of unfinished stories, some of which may only be a line, an opening sentence, some of which may be 10 pages long. At some point, I say, well, I don't know where I'm going with this, and I'll go and move away from that and start on something else. But the lovely part about that is occasionally I go back and start looking through my files, and suddenly I say, oh, I know where I should go with this. And I'll pick up a story that I abandoned 10 years ago, and suddenly I have an idea on how to go forward with it. So over the course of time, I have written things and abandoned them when I've completed them because they were not good enough, or I've abandoned them partially because I didn't have a really good focus on what was going to happen next. And so if I find myself at odd ends, nothing I'm working on is going anywhere right now. I might just go back and start flipping through files. And because I've been away from the original idea so long, it's fresh again. And I have a new perspective. I'm not writing myself into a corner anymore. So ideas are everywhere. Beginnings are everywhere. Ends are really hard. At the end of a story or a novel, I never know where I'm going.
Ah, so you're a bit of a pantser then?
I'm a pantser all the way. And I have, over the course of time, come across the fact that other writers are not like that. There was one writer I read about, I can't remember who it was, who always got the ending first and then wrote the rest of the novel. And that floors me. I never have the ending. And it's getting to the ending that makes it so much of a journey for me, because I don't know what will be encountered. And it's somewhat of a surprise for me, as much as it will be for the reader, I hope, to get from chapter 1 to chapter 6, to get from chapter 6 to chapter 13, whatever. I'm not sure exactly where I'll go. And I love it. I love that part of it. It makes it interesting for me. At the same time that, yes, it can be terribly frustrating. And I'm not afraid. I make so many wrong turns when I'm writing a story or a novel. And I said, you know, sort of like, okay, let's see where this goes. If it goes nowhere, then I'll backtrack and I'll pick up the last part that I thought was working, and then I'll go forward from there. So I may end up with a draft file with, you know, multiple pieces that were abandoned. And then I'll store that, make a copy of it, get rid of all the old stuff in the copy and go forward from there. And again, I might accumulate more and more legs as I go along. But, you know, why not just go for a little while and see what happens? If something occurs to you, let's try it. I can always... Yeah. Deleting is easy, you know?
Yeah. So, it hurts the ego a little bit when you have to cut it all, but you've just got to get past that, haven't you? Yeah. So, I know what you mean. I try and do a little bit of sort of pantsing, and I have enjoyed it. I did it with a draft of, I call it a Scouse fantasy, which is, Scouse, if you're not sure, Scouses are people from where I'm from, Liverpool. And that just was dead easy to write. Like, I wasn't thinking about it at all. I just had the characters and then I was going with it. And that was quite good. But I know what you mean when you sort of go in one direction and then you hit a bit of a wall. It's like knowing how to get out of that, isn't it? It's a bit of a labyrinth sometimes. Yeah.
Well, a labyrinth is exactly the right way to describe it, because in a labyrinth you can go make the wrong turn, but you don't just lie down and die. You go back and pick up where you think the turn went wrong, and you give yourself another direction, and that's the only way to get out of the labyrinth. And I think for some people it just doesn't work. Some people who are plotters, they have to know where they're going. And the fact that there are people who can plot out a whole book they haven't written yet, again, I've done that occasionally. One has to do it to apply for a grant. And it's just like, I could put anything down I want. You know? I don't really have to know what this book is, because they don't know either. You know, so I could put down anything. And I've done that a couple of times. Just, okay, if this, then that. You know, it's almost like a math problem.
Yeah.
You come up with a plot outline. It's definitely not going to be the book I'm going to write, but they want a plot outline. Here's an outline.
Yeah. What do you think the benefits of being a pantser are?
I think it's definitely a personality type. I mean, for me, I like the unexpected in a story. I think novels and stories that I like the most are the ones that surprise me a little. So I imagine, just extrapolating from that, I like to be a little surprised as I write. The same way I like to be a little surprised as I read. Every once in a while, I'm sure this happens to you as well. Every once in a while, I'll stop and say, no, wait a minute. Haven't I already written this story? Isn't this pretty much the same as that other story I wrote? The story itself is no longer surprising me. It's feeling familiar. And I don't like reading a book that feels familiar, or a story that, you know, that feels familiar. So I guess if I did a plot outline, it would probably feel too familiar.
I've spoken to people, and I've done this myself as well, where you plot something out, and as you work your way through that plot, and you get to know the characters better, things just don't really work. And you can get a bit frustrated or a bit worked up because you've created this framework and things aren't like working out for it. So you can get a bit tied up in knots, can't you? It's a good way to sort of move on to creating characters, because like you say, the literary style does focus more on it. And I really love the characters and the way that you've written your characters in The Splendid City.
Well, the interesting thing is there are character people and there are plot people, and I am very clearly a plot person. So as I write, I have to keep reminding myself that don't assume everyone is visualizing this the way that I'm visualizing it. Well, I guess it's one of the reasons I keep mentioning to you how much I enjoyed the episode with the FBI person.
Oh, Joan of Arc,
Yeah, because I have to keep reminding myself to keep putting, you know, touchy-feely things in, to keep the emotions in, to keep putting that stuff in, because that's how we get attached to characters. And if you're not attached to a character, you tend to fall out of the story at some point without having a desire to go back. So I'm a plot person. For me, I have to always keep at my back, keep reminding myself not to forego character. But of course, then we get to, what's a revision for, if not to fill in the things that you didn't take care of the first time around? So, you know, that's a major part of revising for me, is to make sure that I'm touching the character as much as I need to, and not just plot. And also dialogue. I have to say, one of my failings is that I love dialogue. I, even as I'm writing a story or a book, I tend to get episodes of dialogue in my head that I have to write down. Don't know when I'm going to use it. But I find the dialogue to be so amusing that I get it a lot more than I get anything else. So I'm almost a dialogue driven person occasionally. And I think, you know, that's okay. I really haven't heard other people say that. So I don't know whether it's just something we all assume to be true. And it just never comes to the conversation.
It's a great approach to say, because it's hard to get dialogue right, and some people really struggle with it, and try as they might, they just can't get that sort of obliqueness of it, I think is a good way to describe it, the sort of back and forths and the witticisms, and it can be quite hard. So if you've got a natural flair for it, it's brilliant, and you definitely have, just reading your stories. So it's have you got any advice for how you approach writing dialogue?
Dialogue, it springs out of my head without even working on it. I mean, some people are very good at conveying characters. I think that I convey characters through dialogue more than anything else. And it's because I've got dialogue running in my head 80% of the day. Have you come across, I think there was last year or the year before, there was some sort of study that said that not everybody has dialogue running through their head.
And I said, how is that?
I know. How's that possible? All day long, my head is talking.
Yeah. You know, and I wish it would shut up.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's sleeping really hard. But it amazed me that there actually are a number of people who don't have that. And I don't know what their head is filled with in the course of the day. I don't understand.
I find that quite scary to think about.
Yeah,
because as annoying as it is, it keeps you company, I suppose, especially when you're writing.
But I don't have to worry. I mean, we're all so used to reading something all day long. You have 5 minutes. Oh, you pick up a magazine or you check a website or whatever. You're constantly entertaining or distracting yourself. And I've gone to saying, no, wait a minute. We all need to sit down for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever amount of time it is. Nothing distracting us, and just think what happens when we do that. It's it's how I grew up, basically, when we didn't have electronics this way. And it's not bad. You know, I have to say, it's not a terrible thing not to be reading something and to actually just be thinking.
Go back to the dialogue there. If it flows out, like, I don't really have a problem with dialogue, because like you, it sort of just comes out. And I worked in a pub over the course of my life. I've worked in pubs, and I've just sat there and listened to people talk.
Oh, that's so excellent.
Yeah. And like when you were saying, like getting the train or the subway or something like that, like you hear over listening to how people talk, it's so funny, and you learn so much, don't you?
My favorite writing spot years ago was a bar. Mexican bar. Nice. And I had margaritas and chips, and I just sit there for a while, and all out I would be writing, of course, but I was listening to everyone's conversation and writing down bits and pieces of dialogue, because I love dialogue, and I love a little like Stan the cat, who's always listening in on everybody. I guess a part of me is a little bit like Stan, because I love overhearing stuff. But I love the cadence of dialogue. I love the way people speak, the repetition. Well, that gets on my nerves, but people repeat themselves endlessly.
You do?
So much of overhearing people and listening to people when you don't have to respond to them, which is a totally different thing. that's dialogue happening around you naturally. And it can influence. I mean, I loved it. So listening to other people speak probably influences the fact that I've always got people speaking in my head. It's not always me.
One thing I really liked about The Thunder City was the uniqueness of the setting and how Texas has seeded away from the US and rebranded itself as a 1984 style city. How did you approach the creation of that setting?
I actually went through the first time I finished the novel, Angry Robot, my publisher thought that parts of it weren't quite working. So I went back and redrafted it. And the original State of Liberty was a lot more authoritarian. When I went back and started rewriting it, I had more fun with it. And I was very much paying attention to various things. Various states in the United States have threatened to secede and have not. Various parts of the city of New York have threatened to secede and have not. So I was basically picking up bits and pieces of things that were coming and going in the public discussions or public complaints about life in the United States. Some of them from both sides of the coin, but a lot of them from my side of the fence, not coin. And it started being built. And also, as I said, this version of the novel just kept accumulating more and more references to other things like Philip K. Dick and The Wizard of Oz and a couple of more things. Because, again, it's a world. When you read a book, you want to enjoy the world that is the book. And if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to stay with it. The same thing is true when you're writing. If you're not enjoying the world that you're in when you're writing, you're going to abandon it. Which reminds me, something I always love to say is apparently Kafka used to himself when he was writing. Now, of all the people in the world who would laugh while they were writing these dark, dark stories, I would never have expected it to be Kafka. But when I heard that, I said, huh, in a way, if as a writer, you're not enjoying the bizarre things you're writing as well as the realistic things you're writing, and in essence, laughing in joy, merriment, whatever, then I don't think your readers will either. So the first rule for me is to enjoy it. And since it's a satire, what happens with a satire is you generally take something that is in some way, shape, or form already happening, and you just push the limit. So I pushed the limit on a lot of things. There's been terrible water shortages in the West, so I had a swollen river. You know, there have been disappearing people at the borders, so I had a van that picks up people. So there were lots of little things I picked up and sort of inserted without focusing on them, because I had focused too much on real-time events. And as Angry Robot said, a lot of the things in the original version of this were sort of time-stamped. They wouldn't always be true because they relied too much on what was current. And so I made it a little bit more metaphorical, more satirical, more less like the exact thing that was happening and more like what would happen if this got pushed farther.
Yeah. It's interesting you're talking about working with Angry Robot there, because one question I wanted to ask was, given how long you've been working in the publishing industry, what is your experiences of it and how has it changed over the years?
Well, I was mostly a literary writer, and most of my books have been published through small presses. And there's a difference from one small press to the other, and it always comes down to marketing. If you have a small press that wants your book, but they don't have any marketing behind it, your book is just going to, you know, get no notice whatsoever. If you go to a small press that has a marketing strategy, that's good. As opposed to a fairly somewhat larger press that doesn't have any marketing presence. What you really want is someone with a good reputation who actually markets, i.e. they get reviews from the major outlets. They have a way, they belong to NetGalley or somewhere else where they can get individual reader reviews. They have to have a way of getting your name out there, because right now, especially with so much self-publishing going on, there's a flood. How does anyone find your book amidst the flood of X million books being printed every year? So I don't know. I think there's much more right now, much more diversity in publishing. When, you know, it used to be basically old white men in the 60s and 70s with a few token women and black people. And now there's much more, especially, I think, I'm not sure it's true, but I think speculative community is a bit more openly diverse and clear-sightedly diverse than literary is. And that's new. And yes, it can lead to a feeling of people who are just coming on scene now who feel that they're being ignored because they are white and male. And it's just like, no, it's just more of a level playing field. And
we've
gotten rid of, you know, you have more competition from other people now. That's all it is. And it's a shame that you feel that way, but basically not everyone succeeds. And if you cannot, if you want to be a writer, you have to face the fact that the number of people who A, can make a living out of it, and B, can feel satisfaction from the amount of notice they're getting, those are very small numbers. The majority of writers don't make a living at it and always feel that they should have gotten an award. So it's not an easy world, and you have to enjoy it, and you have to get satisfaction first of all from your own writing. And by that I mean you have to be satisfied when you've written something, even if you never sent it out. You're proud of it.
And enjoy the process.
Yes, enjoy the process, but also look at the fact that you did something, you accomplished something. Not everyone can do it. I've done one watercolor painting in my life. I took a class. I did a watercolor. I'm really proud of that. I'm never, ever going to do another one, but it gives me a little bit satisfaction looking at it and saying, hey, I did that. And it's not terrible, you know? Yeah. And I think if you can't take satisfaction in having done something good as your immediate first step, then you're going to have a miserable time being a writer.
Oh yeah, most definitely. I can attest to that. Karen, got one last question for you before we finish. What single piece of advice would you give to anyone thinking about giving writing a go?
The first thing is to find your voice. I think it's odd. As I said, I taught a number of years at NYU, and very often I come across people. Two things. I've come across people who wanted to be, this was their goal, best-selling authors. Not a good writer, but a best-selling author. Okay. And I'd come across other people and I'd mention books and they wouldn't know. I'd ask what their favorite book was and they had no answer. So two things. Read perpetually. Always read. Always be aware of what's being written. Always be aware of the world. Oh, I forgot the second thing. Anyway, find your voice. That's where I started. I think I lost track of something along the way. Very often people think they have to sound like a proper English writer. Yeah. And they fail to find their natural voice. It's like singing in the wrong key. And I think you have to go through a period of writing through that. If you feel that you have to sound like Jane Austen or Stephen King or anybody, then write through that, you know, get that out of your system. But then work through it and realize that it's not you.
Yeah.
You have to find the thing that is you. And for that, I think I forget who the writer is, said you have to write 100 stories before you write one good one. I don't know that it's 100 specifically for every writer, but you have to keep writing, even if it's a paragraph, doesn't matter. The more you write, the more you will very naturally tend towards your true voice, your true style, and also your true subject. So be willing to take a risk, find your voice, and keep reading. I guess those would be the main things.
The holy trinity of wonderful pieces of advice. Nice. Thank you very much, Karen. It's been wonderful chatting with you.
It's been wonderful for my end too. I really enjoyed this so much. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you very much. Where's the best place to find out more about you?
Oh, well, my website is a good start, although I'm revising it yet again because I only, well, I get halfway through and I get distracted, but it's my name. It's www.karenhuler.com, and that's KarenHeuler. Or you can just look up The Splendid City on Amazon to get the right spelling of my name because it's often misspelled, and track me down that way.
Cool. I'll put links for everything in the description as well. So, yeah, thank you very much, Karen, and thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you very much again, Karen. It was a truly fantastic interview. Absolutely lovely talking with you, and I learned so much. And you can see why Karen has taught creative writing in colleges and universities. And knowledge is absolutely excellent and absolutely wonderful approach to teaching as well. So thank you very much. I really appreciated that, Karen. And I hope you enjoyed it at home too. If you did enjoy today's episode, a quick share on social media or with anyone who you think may be interested goes a very long way. And if you don't want to miss any future episodes, give us a follow or subscribe to the show. Episodes are every 2 weeks, but sometimes we bring one out in between. So if you don't want to miss any, if you want to get a little notification when one goes live, then just give us a follow. If you want to come along to our next panel event on the 25th of June, then be sure to join our Discord community. You can find the link in the description. We're thrilled to welcome science fiction and fantasy literary agent Laura Bennett. So if you want to find out about query letters, how to get an agent, what an agent does, and how you can get a traditional publishing deal, then you want to join us and ask all the questions you want. And that is about it for today. Thank you very, very much for listening. And until next time, keep on scribbling.